WNST, Towson, Baltimore. Keeping calm, staying local, and always Baltimore positive. Nothing more positive than the conversation we're about to have with an old friend. Before we get to that, I want to give a shout-out to all of our sponsors, including State Fair, where I made a drive-by chicken and waffles with raspberry and butter jalapeno sauce on Tuesday. It was delectable. It was delicious. Can't wait to get back to some sense of normalcy with Evan Brown and our friends over in Catonsville, where Don Moeller is. Don Moeller has been enjoying some Fadley's crab cakes, as well as some Taharka Honey Graham ice cream. Don got say a few words about Taharka, because I've been carrying on about it, but if this were later in the day, my mouth would be full right now, and I would let you talk to Michael Olesker about it.
I would just say to everybody, including our guests, just jump on the web, hit Taharka, go to Taharka's website. It's so easy to order. They bring it right to your front door, and then you're going to have to be really careful, because Nestor, I thought you and others might be exaggerating, but you're not. It may be the best ice cream we've ever had. And my wife is an ice cream connoisseur, without a doubt. And we have been, we ordered, we come by the case, so we ordered eight pints, and we've been blowing through the flavors. Every one is better than the one before, so can't welcome Taharka enough, and not just because they're a sponsor. If you like ice cream, jump on the website, order some. It comes right to your front door. You will not be disappointed.
Well, we're looking forward to getting back to Fadley's and State Fair, and of course our friends at Moeller and Gary. Jeff Moeller closing deals out there with mask on, showing homes online, doing it all safely. Find them at Moeller and Gary, and I'm going to get Jeff on here after the election. Don, I'm going to let you do the honors on this one, because every time I talk to this guy, he calls me kid. And I love it. The only thing he could call me that would make me even happier would be if he called me Hard Metal, which was John Steadman's nickname for me back at the Baltimore News American. So you go ahead and do the honors here on Michael Olesker.
That's because Michael and I are old, but it is a pleasure to welcome to Baltimore Positive, longtime, really an icon, Baltimore reporter Michael Olesker, WJZ, currently with Jay Moore. Michael, welcome to Baltimore Positive.
It's great to be here. It's great to be talking with two old friends.
It's great to hear your voice. And I guess there's this is the timing. And look, we would have loved to have you out for a crab cake at Fadley's or shrimp and grits over at State Fair. And we got ice cream now. But we find ourselves in this pandemic where I'm holding the ballot for mayor. I'm holding the ballot here for city council president. I've already filled in for Bill Henry. You know, the history of doing these kinds of conversations, and you and I have been friends through baseball and sports and journalism and all this, but it got personal for me 2 years ago when I've seen this TV con man maniac running the country on a daily basis. And I saw Don running Baltimore County after the incredibly tragic death of Kevin Kamenetz that summer. So right about 2 years ago now, my wife and I had a bad experience in Fells Point, and I started to ask the question, can this thing be fixed? And elections are where we try to fix these things and where we try to make them better. You've been at this a lot longer than I, and you know, I've seen Avalon, and I talked to Barry Levinson about this last year and what Baltimore looked like in the 40s and the 50s, and Don tells me about losing his dog at Friendship Airport when the Colts won a championship in 58, and I grew up reading you and Steadman and all of that. And I grew up in the early 80s seeing William Donald Schaefer come down and take a plot of grass and turn it into what is literally my backyard and where I've chosen to live the last two decades of my life at the Inner Harbor. You've seen all of this, and we're waiting for this next thing. And I was getting on airplanes 2 years ago, landing in Cleveland, Detroit, Indianapolis, Charlotte, Nashville, all these places I used to go to and say, these places suck. Baltimore's way better than that. Even though we lost our football team, our place is better than that. We got the harbor, we got this, we got that. And now 25 years later, I go to these places and see that they've lifted, they were inspired by Baltimore and lifted their communities up. Detroit, I mean, and we're now at that place where we need this election and the things that we're doing here to make our place better. And I know how frustrated people of your, we talked to Dan Rodgers and Don airs his frustration, but anybody that came even before me sees Baltimore in a different light. And I think it's incumbent upon all of us to listen to our elders to say, we made this place great one time and we can do it again. And here's how we got to do it. We got to go at this a different way.
Well, I think that we're talking about a city that is right now the victim of its own narrative. You mentioned William Donald Schaefer. I covered his first campaign for mayor back in 70-71. Don, you remember that. You remember that Schaefer was city council president before that. I remember trailing him around and watching him campaign. He was the antithesis of the person he became. As mayor, he was this guy wearing funny hats and dipping into the seal pool in a turn-of-the-century bathing suit. And those are things we remember him for. As a first-time campaigner for mayor, it was painful to watch him. He was the most shy individual you ever saw. People knew him from being on the council for years. They would come up to him, "Hey, Don, how you doing?" He couldn't even make eye contact. He was so shy. "Hi, how you doing?" I was embarrassed for him, and I was embarrassed for all the people who were greeting him so warmly and not getting the warmth in return. Now, the reason I'm bringing all this up is because as mayor, he took on a role. And that was a chief cheerleader. Look, he already knew every brick in town. He had been on the council for years. He had been city council president for a term. The issue wasn't whether he knew what was going on with the city, but what he was going to do about it. Now, remember, in 70, 71, 72, we were still living under the shadow of the 68 riots. There were people who were saying, "I will never go downtown again," just as they're saying it now in the extended aftermath of the Freddie Gray riots, which were a tiny, tiny fraction of what we went through in 68. What Schaefer did was he established a new narrative. That narrative was, and Don, you remember this, Ernesto, you may be young, Baltimore is best. Remember that, Don?
Absolutely.
I grew up as a young boy in the 70s. Baltimore is best. And the hot shot, Artie Donovan shooting baskets at trash cans to get the trash off the street.
Right.
All of that. Yeah. And we've spoken with Wasserman, and we've gone at length with Fraser about all of the history of his legend, and his statue sits at the foot of my home. Someone put a mask on it last week, Michael, and I had to share the picture of Mayor Schaefer. I call him Mayor, not Governor Schaefer, right? But, we sort of look back at that as sort of this glory period, Camelot thing, and I would say there's a large portion of Baltimore that doesn't look at him in that way because it didn't fix their side of town, right?
All right, but this isn't... Let me get back to this idea of narrative.
Sure.
I'm not here to say that William Donald Schaefer was the greatest, was our version of FDR. He didn't get a grip on a number of things, including the public school system. There is still obviously a big difference economically between blacks and whites in this town. But what he did was, though, He got this narrative going that we were terrific. And, you say something long enough, and unfortunately Trump is proving that.
Matt.
Even if you're not telling the truth, a certain number of people will believe it. Well, in Schaefer's case, it was a benign lie that Baltimore was bested, it was great. And O'Malley was calling Baltimore the greatest city in America. Again, trying to establish a narrative. Now, here's the other thing to keep in mind. Schaefer became mayor and was mayor for 15 years at a time when we still had in Baltimore mass media. When I was writing columns for the Baltimore Sun, I was probably writing for 500,000 people three times a week. when I was simultaneously doing nightly commentaries on WJZ, roughly the same number of people. And I, you know, look, you guys know what it's like to speak in public. When I started at JZ, you can't imagine a more nervous person than I was. And I sat down that first night on the air between Jerry Turner and Al Sanders, two of the greatest guys imaginable, and two of the most popular guys imaginable. And I'm terrified. And I remember one of the cameramen in the studio saying to me, "Hey, relax. There's only 500,000 people going to be watching this." Well, you know, I got through it okay, and I was on for 20 years. But the larger point is, it was a mass medium. Schaefer was coming of age at a time when television was really finding itself with the new electronic hardware, the ability to take cameras anywhere. And he knew also that TV wasn't so interested in issues as it was in pretty pictures. He gave us those pictures by putting on funny hats and dipping into the seal pool. But while he was there, he was establishing a narrative in our heads. Hey, Baltimore is fun. Hey, it's okay to go downtown. We don't have mass media anymore. When I was at the Sun, our newsroom had more than 400 people in it, and we were covering everything, not only in Baltimore, but around the world. Today, never mind having a bureau in London or Paris, they don't have a Baltimore County Bureau. They don't have 400-plus people in the newsroom. They have under 100. They don't have 500,000 people reading it every day. It's under 100,000. Television, local TV, they don't have 500,000 people. They have maybe 20,000 people in the whole state who are watching it at one time. We don't have mass media the way we used to. And what I'm getting at is, if you're the next mayor, what do you do to reach that mass audience? We are so fractured as an audience now that I don't know how we begin to craft that new narrative that the city needs so desperately, because the narrative right now, following the two mayors who have left office in disgrace, following the succession of police commissioners who just couldn't get things together, in the midst of this horrible year after year, the killings that go on the street, we have not found a way to deal with the drug traffic, to deal with these kids who are coming from broken homes. And so in a desperate, tragic, poignant search for some kind of family, they reach for a gang. And they're the ones who are shooting and killing each other now. And so, you know, particularly in the aftermath of the Freddie Gray riots, you've got all these people who have abandoned the city. We are now at 600,000 population, where in the post-war years we were at nearly a million. We have lost. Yeah, you can do the arithmetic yourself. But you know, I've got friends who live in the suburbs, who say, "I will not go downtown again. I will not go into the city of Baltimore again." And I say to them, "Look, I live two blocks from Plimico Racetrack. I'm downtown in 5 minutes. There are neighborhoods in town where you don't want to go, but there are scores of neighborhoods in town where you do want to go, where it is fabulous. The unfortunate thing is we live in two cities, the city of haves and the city of have-nots, and we have got to, you know, spread the wealth, spread the joy, so that we're all participating in the good stuff that's going on in the city. But that's the narrative that we have to get out there. You know, we love being with each other. This pandemic is awful because, among other things, it's isolating us. so much. Think back to the early 70s again. We're living in the shadow of the riots, and they came up with this idea. Schaefer was a big part of this, but there were other people too. Hope Quackenbush, Sandy Hillman, Chris Hartman. Let's do a Baltimore City Fair. And there were people who said, you can't do that. Are you kidding? We will have riots downtown. And what happened? They had it, and the first night we had a hurricane, and it knocked over all these exhibits, and everybody said, oh, well, this is tragic. No, it was the best thing, because people who were down there from every neighborhood in town reached out to help each other. And over that weekend, there were 500,000 people who came downtown who hadn't been there in years because they were frightened, and they learned, hey, you know what? This isn't so bad. And that, too, fed into that new narrative that Schaefer was trying to get established. And for, what, 20 years, we had these city fairs, and we still have, you know, Artscape, and we also had these great ethnic festivals for years. My point is, when we get out there and we mix with each other, we find that we like being with each other. If we can get over this idea that we are dangerous to each other, we've got to establish some kind of new narrative. But I don't know how you do it if you are the new mayor. Where do you go to find a mass audience today? I don't know.
Well, Michael, you touched, boy, there is so much in there to talk about related to today, to the future. Interesting that you mentioned the city fairs. And you're right about the need to connect. And it's so hard to do that in these times. Just last week, a good friend of mine sent me some vintage footage, and it had to do, again, really with the themes you're talking about. I said, look back to this footage decades ago, and it was vintage film of one of the early city fairs. And just as you described, it was all ethnicities, all races, big, small, short, tall, you name it, just with smiles on their face, just coming together to celebrate community. And you certainly are writing about this now in Jay Moore as you capture these themes. One of the things that worries me, Michael, is that we're losing a sense of community in a real sense of those things that bring us together. You mentioned Martin O'Malley. Even a young Martin O'Malley, you know, 34, 35 years old, when he stood on that street corner running against Carl Stokes and Lawrence Bell, saying, we're better than this. You know, we black and white, we're stronger together. We're more than unites us than divides us. We can all see a young Martin O'Malley, the guitar-playing city councilman, who, again, helped us believe. How do we get back, Michael? How do we get back to that kind of energy that makes us believe both in our community here in Baltimore and as a nation?
Well, here's something that I always try to keep in mind. Cities are a place where, there used to be a theme that cities were dying in America. The fact is, pieces of cities die while other pieces of cities are being reborn. I started out as a young sports writer at a newspaper called The News American.
Hey, we have that in common. How about that?
Yes, we do. And we both think of John Steadman as not only our dear friend, but a kind of a godfather. Wonderful, wonderful man. And I used to look out the back window of the News American, which overlooked Pratt Street.
Wow.
And Pratt Street back then was, frankly, it was rotting piers, and it was, winos and, seagulls that missed the last flight out of town. And what happened to that? It became a place called Harbor Place. It was an area that everybody said was dying, and it was reborn. Think of
what did they call it before that? I mean, before it was Harbor Place, what did you call that? Did you call it the pier, the harbor? What was the word for
harbor,
that?
The harbor.
The harbor, okay.
Yeah, But think of all those waterfront neighborhoods. I mean, think of what Boston Street used to be like. There was nothing there. Now it's million-dollar homes. Think about what Canton was like and how at Fells Point, which used to be known as the foot of Broadway. Think of Federal Hill. These are all very hip neighborhoods. Locust Point. These are neighborhoods where young people clamor to get in, where people from Washington who can't afford, you know, housing in Washington move to Baltimore. There are lots of neighborhoods in Baltimore that were once pronounced dead or dying that have been reborn. This is what happens in cities. But again, that narrative, we've got to get past that narrative that all is lost. But how do you get that message out? That's called leadership. And I'm looking at these, you know, six main candidates for mayor now. I wish I could make up my mind. I frankly haven't been able to. I had a pretty good interview the other day on the phone with Brandon Scott. I wrote about him in today's J-More magazine, and it's on the website, and it's on Facebook. You feel the passion when he talks about wanting to help the city where he grew up. I wish he had given me more dynamic ideas.
Well, the Baltimore Sun called him a visionary, and I said, "Look, I've talked to Brandon. I like Brandon, and Brandon might win, but visionary, I wouldn't go there yet."
I wouldn't either. And my big concern about him is that he's a very young guy. You know, O'Malley was a young guy too. My problem, I guess, with somebody who's in his mid-30s who has not been around a lot is a texture, a depth of experience. I recently reread Fraser Smith's biography of William Donald Schaefer, and what struck me most forcefully is how prepared Schaefer was, how he knew every inch of Baltimore, knew how to make the system work. And, you know, I hope that whoever the next mayor is will know how to do that, but I certainly don't see anybody with the kind of experience that Schaefer had. Again, an imperfect man, an imperfect mayor, but a guy who came into office fully prepared. And I'm not sure which of these candidates is that person.
Well, Michael, it's interesting that you mentioned Fraser's book. We've had Fraser on Baltimore Positive twice. He talked about William Donald Schaefer at length. And one of the things that he zeroed in on with William Donald Schaefer was the fact that he was absolutely passionate about finding the best and the brightest people to be part of his administration. And the fact that he did not need to be the smartest guy in the room, but he wanted really committed people on his team to help him make the city better. And I think that's one of the things that we all hope for in a next mayor. But I'm curious.
Let me address that for a moment, Don.
Yeah, sure.
Because no mayor is better than the people he has around him or she has around her. Schaefer had, for example, Bob Embry out of housing, and all the so many of the best ideas. And Embry was one of the people who got behind that first city fair. But so many of the good ideas that were moving the city back then came out of Embry's housing department, to the point where Jimmy Carter brought him to Washington, as an undersecretary of HUD. Any mayor has to surround himself with good people. I love Kurt Schmoke. I admire him in so many ways. I think a big problem that his administration had, in addition to catching a bad break historically with the crack epidemic, was that he did not surround himself with good people. We instead of having a Bob Embry at housing, we had a Danny Henson at housing, and the less said about that, the better. Here's something else that Schaefer did that he doesn't get enough credit for. he brought in, he surrounded himself with really smart women. Joan Baresca, Janet Hoffman, Hope Quackenbush, Sandy Hillman, Marion Pines, on and on and on. And, you know, this was way before women had made the kind of strides, thank God, that they have made in our era.
Well, Barbara Mikulski loved sitting down last year and telling us about the fights with Schaefer,
oh,
which
yeah.
I'm sure you refereed in the newspaper back in the day.
Well,
right?
You know, Schaefer and I had a few. He was a colorful guy. You know, he was easily angered. He was. I could tell you stories, but they may go a little too long. But he was.
Well, it's funny that everyone speaks of him in such reverential tones, and there's a statue and stuff. And you know, to you, he's a guy who changed the city. But you still fought with him anyway because being held accountable, he felt like that was part of his gig, right?
Well, I mean, that's the job of a newspaper columnist, a TV commentator, is to hold politicians accountable, to cast a critical eye, I saw much to admire. He's the guy who brought my city back to life, and so I admired him for that. Did he make mistakes? Did he have flaws? Yeah, and we fought about them. But to the end of his life, we remained people who respected each other, and I count that as a good thing, that we each understood our roles.
Again, we are going to have you back. When we're with longtime News American, Baltimore Sun, WJZ, reporter, commentator, currently with Jay Moore, Michael Olesker, truly a legend in the Baltimore media world. As I said, we're going to have you back on at some point because there's so much to discuss. When you just talked about your relationship with William Donald Schaefer, and you remain to the end two people who respected one another and had an admiration for one another, I think that's where I get so frustrated. One of the litany of things that I could fill a book with about this president that frustrates me is I try to say to my friends who jump on this crazy, the press is the enemy of the people, you can't trust the media, and I tell them, I said, folks, I've dealt with the media for 30 years. Now, did we always agree? No. Did I get angry at them? Did they get angry at me? Of course. But they were never, ever the enemy of the people. I kid Jane Miller all the time, and we're going to have Jane on soon. But my safety, we laugh about it. I used to say, the words that would make every elected official or chief of staff shudder was when somebody come in my office and say, hey, Don, Jane's on the phone. It was like, oh, my God. You know, because you knew Jane was going to dig down, ask hard questions, and hold you accountable. I use Brian Sears, who's now at the Daily Record, as an example. Brian was a bulldog, and Brian covered me and my bosses, I mean, really, in a really, really tough way. But never, ever did I have an incident where I said what you wrote wasn't true. I may not like that you wrote it. I may have a different perception as to why we did what we did. But we've lost that, Michael. And it seems to me that of the many things this president does, that a real danger to our democracy is his effort to convince the public that they can't believe facts. As a career reporter, give us your view of that part of the national scene.
Well, I think that Donald Trump is a very dangerous man. Look, this is, I don't agree with his politics, but this isn't about politics per se. This is a mean-spirited bully. There's, you know, I can't think of too many traits that are worse than calling someone a bully. He looks for those who are easy to pick on. He makes stuff up. The lies are, what are they, approaching 18,000 now that have been documented?
I've never had a human being anywhere in my life that I've ever encountered that speaks with the fluency of lies. You know what I mean? Like, just literally, we've all had a, you know, for lack of a better term, a bullshitter in our life. You know what I mean? Like, we know what that looks like. We've had that in business somewhere in our life, some maybe in our family, somewhere that person doesn't always tell the truth, or they're some white lie. This is, it's incredible. I mean, it's astonishing. The fluency for a lifetime, you know, that the stacks and stacks of this back in the 70s and 80s and 90s that have been built up and yet 63 million people, Michael. It's incredible.
I was just going to say, Michael, put your Dr. Phil, and thanking us, that's a great segue. Put your Dr. Phil hat on, Michael. What is it that makes 63 million people buy into this and have them screaming at reporters? I remember after the election last time, I read Katie Couric's book on covering the Trump campaign from the beginning. And one night her mother called her in tears, asked her to please if she could ask for another assignment because of the way she was being screamed at and threatened by these people in these red MAGA hats at these rallies. Put your Dr. Phil hat on and your years of experience, and educate Esther and me into what you think's happening.
Well, I think part of it, again, it comes down to media. I'll watch CNN or MSNBC, or I'll read the Baltimore Sun, or the New York Times, which I read every day, and the Washington Post, and I will read and see this stuff, and I will be appalled. And I'll say to myself, well, how can people know, and they're all exposing these lies, and I'll say to myself, how can people know this and yet still buy into his bull? And I come up with the same answer every time, and that is there are millions and millions of people who are not hearing this because they're getting their information from Fox or from Limbaugh, or from any of these right-wing radio broadcasts, that it's a whole different set of, you know, you can't even call them facts, that they're hearing and that they're not hearing. And these are people who there's no getting facts across to them because they have been exposed to a whole different litany for the last 3.5 years.
Well, they've also not spent the first 30, 40, 50, 60 years of their lives reading books or subscribing to science. I mean, along that line as well, you know, what you're willing to believe, if you haven't read a newspaper in 30 years, whatever the man on the television tells you, who looks like you and feels like you and shares your anger, even if it's Archie Bunker crazy, you know, like literally some of this stuff is straight Archie Bunker, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and there's also, look, I don't want to claim that everyone who likes Donald Trump is a racist, but a lot of what he says is veiled racism, and, you know, from Charlottesville seeing good people on both sides of a clearly racist anti-Semitic demonstration, to, you know, let's keep immigrants out of America, and the immigrants he's talking about happen to be people of color in many cases. But, you know, that has been a lot of his appeal, a kind of a veiled racism.
Michael Olesker is our guest, and I guess this is the time for you to talk about your second afterlife as a columnist that shows up on my newspaper every day on the front of my Facebook feed. A little oxygen to the new world of digital, which wasn't always easy on the newspaper side, but more than that, Michael, you can get off the phone with us right now and go ink a column and have it out to your whole audience in 15 minutes, social media, all of this. For old guys like you and me that saw Hot Metal type back in the day on at the corner of South and Lombard, it is a wide, wide world, isn't it? Of video and Instagram and pictures, and it also allows you to still be extremely relevant on my timeline, pal.
Thank you. I you know, there are lots of outlets these days. I I spent a couple of years doing national radio recently for an outfit called Talk Media News, where I was talking to stations all over the country several times a week. And I've been writing for Jay Moore for a few years, and I write for another website called the Baltimore Post-Examiner, which is also carried on Facebook. You know, I've just been getting lovely, lovely response. And it's nice that, you know, I've reached the three-quarter century mark now, and I feel like I've got new life in that 75 used to mean something that I hope it doesn't mean anymore. It used to be that it was considered a remarkable age, but, you know, people are routinely living into their 90s these days, and I feel as vital as ever. And you know, I hope that I can keep doing this for as long as people want to keep reading me.
Well, if you want to stay alive another two decades, don't be so pissed about the Colts. You got to let that go, Michael.
You're writing great stuff. I encourage everybody to stay up with Michael Lester and Jay Moore. I have to ask you, and I know you're against the clock, real quick before we let you get out of here, and this is a preface to my question. I'm assuming Roderick has written somewhere like 6,000 columns. I'm assuming you're in the same ballpark or more. Are you? I should have asked Dan this. Are reporters like Jim Palmer and Cal? We had Cal on, who remembers every pitch he ever took. Can you remember, Michael? Because I'm going to ask you about an article or two. Can you remember every article that you've ever written? Are reporters like that?
No. I've probably written, well, somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000 columns, between 5,000 and 10,000 broadcasts over TV and or radio, you know, countless magazine pieces. I mean, my memory is pretty good, you know, when we're talking about history. If you ask me what I had for breakfast this morning, that's a different story.
You wrote, there were two. One made me laugh, just that laugh, and then the other actually made me cry. And the one that made me cry, I'm a crier anyway.
Me too.
The one that made me cry was the one you wrote the day after the last game at Memorial Stadium. And I was in the upper deck, and I was with some friends, and I was with my mom, who was in her 70s at the time. And can remember the tears coming down my face as I realized what was happening, as when the Orioles made that brilliant decision just to have the players come out of the dugout at the end to the Field of Dreams music without even telling you. I think the sense was, if I have to tell you who these guys are, you probably shouldn't be here. And the next day, your column, there was part of your column where I can almost remember this sentence verbatim, Michael. You said, for years, moms and dads, actually I can get well off thinking about it now. For years, moms and dads took their kids to Memorial Stadium. Yesterday, the kids returned the favor. I don't know if you remember that column.
Absolutely. I was sitting in the upper deck behind home plate. It was a day when we were all reminiscing about, you know, going there with, you know, parents. You know, it's some of our most treasured moments are not just to have watched the Orioles and the Colts there, but to have been part of a municipal tribe. And that's the thing we have to get back, that feeling that we are all part of the same big community, the same big heartbeat, and that's what makes the places like Memorial Stadium so dear to us. I remember that column very, very vividly.
Wow.
I still weep over it, and I went to high school at City College, and so I used to pass by Memorial Stadium every day on the way to school. Now I pass by, and it's a it's a combination YMCA and old age home.
Well, I got to say to both of you that this is a very timely conversation because my wife and I found ourselves up at Dr. Steve Elliott up on the north side in Paring Parkway, and we would usually take the highway home and go through the tunnel or whatever. And I said to my wife, yeah, let's drive through the city. And she said, okay, let's do that. So we went down Lock Raven, and we got to the corner, and we did Alameda instead of Lock Raven going southbound. Like, I took the left, and I said, let's take Alameda, and we went up, and I got up there, and I'm like, let's make a right. We'll go back through Hopkins. I want to see what's going on. And literally at the red light, my wife looks at me, and she's like, you sure you want to do that? This was like 2 weeks ago, because for years, I would say, let's go up the Harford Road. I don't want to go by and see it because it would really upset me. It would really upset me to drive by 33rd Street. You know,
I
can do it now, but I'm having a harder time telling you about the last day at Memorial Stadium because it wrecked me. So, you know.
I'm telling you the story, and I'm sitting here in the chair, and I started to well up again thinking about my mom.
Well, we're three for three.
We were up for next. Hey, Nestor, quick question, and I know Michael's got to run. A funny story about Michael and his writing ability. I have a friend that I was with at Lansdowne High School for years, Gary Levin. Gary was college buddies with Michael, and Gary was an outstanding English teacher. And one day, Gary and I were shooting the breeze, and I said, hey, Gary, what did you decide? You went for the Diamondback, and you were a journalist. What did you decide you would be an English teacher instead of a journalist? And he said, well, it was pretty easy. He said, one day I started to read what Michael was writing, and I started to read what I was writing, and I thought, I think I'm going to be an English teacher. So, a high praise from Gary Levin for your effort all the way back then, Michael.
Well, he was sports editor of the Poly Press when I was sports editor of the City College Collegian. And he has told that story, but it's not true. Gary happens to be a terrific writer
and a very funny writer
as well, but it's very kind of him to say that. Real quickly, I can, like you guys, I can remember the first time I went to Memorial Stadium with my father and looking up at that inscription, time will not dim. And I felt, I was 9 years old, and I felt as if I were entering a holy place just from that inscription. And went in, and unfortunately the rest of the evening didn't play out quite that way because Whitey Ford pitched a three-hitter against us. Yankees won 6-0, but I do remember vividly Mickey Mantle hit a home run that night off Ray Moore that must have landed on Greenmount Avenue. We all have great memories of Memorial Stadium. If you have me back another time, we can talk sports. How about that?
Oh, you make me cry. That's
Michael,
all you do.
I hope you'll come back. And so we've just scratched the surface. Continue to love what you're writing on Jay Moore. And really, thanks for being part of all of us over the years, part of the journey, and help really painting the picture of Baltimore and a nation for us. It's invaluable. I can't thank you enough. And we certainly will have you back.
Thank you both for all the kind words.
Hey, man, let's make Baltimore better. Let's get out and vote. I'm holding my little voting certificate up here. We don't need turnout. We need turn in. Fill it out, sign it, and send it in. Don Moeller, former Baltimore County executive, for him and all of our sponsors, including Taharka Ice Cream. I'm going to hold the empty Wake and Bake up here. Moeller has 8 of these in his freezer right now, so you can go grab these. Taharka, made in Baltimore, delicious. Start with the Honey Graham and just go down the slope and make your summer a little better. A lot of things we can't do. One thing we can do is eat ice cream and enjoy it. The other thing we can do is go to a state fair. I went over for some chicken and waffles. It had been 10 weeks and 6 days, I did the math on it, since I last had the chicken and waffles, and it was a mistake waiting that long. It might not be 10 days before I get back over to State Fair in Catonsville. Big thanks to Evan for his support of all we do here at Baltimore Positive, as well as everyone at Fadley's. I had a crab cake, french fries, coleslaw, and mac and cheese to go last week. Don Moeller's made 2 runs that way. I'm going to get back over for a big old crab cake next week as well. Summertime, I got to have 1 crab cake a week. And they're best, and they're local, and they deliver anywhere you are. Fadley's will ship you crab cakes. Go to Fadley's out on the internet. Don't forget Moeller and Gary Realty. If you are buying, selling your home, it's a little more difficult, but Jeff makes it easy. Moeller and Gary Realty, find them out there. They will list it, get it sold, get it on the market, and do it safely online. It's a whole new way of life for everybody. And if Michael Lesker can figure it out, I can figure it out. I am Nestor. Nasty at WNST.net finds me. We are WNST.net, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. Keeping calm, staying local. Nothing more local than Moeller and Lesker together today. And always Baltimore positive.